From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
Hi, and welcome to another John Hannam Meets archive. Today, I'm presenting part one of a mini-series called Gone But Not Forgotten. And my guests will be Tommy Cooper, Russ Conway and Sir John Mills. Firstly, I'm going back to 1982, when Tommy Cooper came to Sandown Pavilion on the Isle of Wight.
John Hannam Meets.
I've interviewed many impressionists on this programme, but here's one that doesn't say just like that. Of course, it's the real Tommy Cooper. Tommy, welcome to the Isle of Wight.
Oh, thank you, John. Thank you very much.
Tommy, have you ever worked over here before?
Never. No, I haven't. And funnily enough, I used to live in Southampton many years ago, well, the other side, in Hythe.
What do you remember about those days?
Well, I was trained to be a shipwright in the British power boat, and I used to do magic. I've done magic since I was about 10 years old, and I used to do tricks for the apprentices there, you know. And all the time I was there, I thought to myself, I've never been to the Isle of Wight.
And you had to wait all these years to come.
It's unbelievable, really.
Let's go back to the early days. You had very strange early beginnings because you were sort of in the guards and then you were at the windmill. It's rather sort of mixed up early beginnings. How did you really get into show business?
Well, when I was apprenticed to be a shipwright, they asked me if I'd do a show for the, you know, everybody there. You know, they had a little stage in the canteen. So when the curtains opened, I had all the tricks ready. I got stage fright. I couldn't speak. I couldn't say anything. I knocked all the props over. The audience started to laugh. I was nearly in tears. And when I came off, I thought, oh dear. And after that, I thought, well, that's what I'm going to do. So that's how it started, doing the tricks that went wrong. So when I went into the army, I started doing tricks like in the NAFI and the sergeant's mess, and I did tricks that went wrong then.
When you came out, I suppose, you sort of got into variety and that type of thing, did you?
Yeah, when I came out, like everybody at the same time came out, we went around to agents, because you had to get an agent. And I started, funny enough, in nightclubs first, in the bottle party days. They used to drink to about 4:30 in the morning, and sometimes I didn't used to go on to about 3 o'clock in the morning. It's a bit late, isn't it?
They still laugh, though, did they?
Oh, yeah, they were very good, very friendly.
Tommy, looking back over your really fantastic career, is there any one moment when you really thought perhaps you'd made it? What was the real big break for you?
Yes, it was a show called, television show called It's Magic with MacDonald Hobley for the BBC. And they asked me to go in there as one of the guest artists. So they kept me on for the whole run of the shows. And that's when I started to become slowly established.
Was it easy for you in those days? I mean, were you sort of very confident of going to great things, or were you sort of a bit dubious?
No, it's just one of those things. I used to enjoy variety. We used to go around and meet a lot of people, you know, friends we knew, and we'd think, oh, we're on the bill next week with somebody. Oh, good. It was hard, but good fun.
Did you ever in your own mind think one day I'll be there in lights? Did you ever hope or think
that? I never thought about it really that way. I just thought, you know, I just went on to do my act and that was it.
Of course, as well as being a knockabout magician, you're rather a serious magician on the quiet,
yes,
aren't you?
I do street magic as a hobby.
Where do you do that, really?
Well, I do it either in a bar or in a restaurant or in the company of friends, you know. I can sit for hours just practicing little tricks.
You've never really done this publicly, have you, on very many occasions?
Well, no, because I did try once, but it doesn't work. They want the tricks to go wrong, see.
Tommy, you're the most impersonated man, I think, in British show business. What do you feel about that? Is it something which you enjoy, being impersonated?
Oh, no, I think it's a great compliment, because I think, you know, it was one good thing about that. I was doing a television series for Thames, and when I went to do it, I hadn't realised myself that I hadn't been on for 3 years because the impressions were on, you know, and a lot of people thought it was me on the television. But I was off television for 3 years. It's hard to believe, isn't it?
Do any do Tommy Cooper better than you?
Well, there's quite a few. Very good. I think Bruce Forsyth is excellent. Mike Yarwood, Russ Abbott.
Where do they get this just like that? Because you don't use it very often, do you?
I use it occasionally, you see. I suppose you get catchphrases which you use, and then sometimes you use one more than the other, you know.
Now, you're such a big man and instantly recognisable. How do you sort of get away? Where can you go when you want to get away from people, really? You're hard to disguise, aren't you, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm very pretty, I suppose. Oh, I don't mind that. I don't mind it. The only thing that does upset me is that if I'm in anywhere, someone has had too much to drink, you know, they come across and sit down beside you, you know, either while you're eating a meal. That's a little bit upsetting.
I notice in some write-ups on you, you've been interested in judo and boxing over the years.
That's
have
right.
you done any yourself?
I've done boxing when I was in the cars, and I've done judo.
How long? Did you do judo for some time?
Yeah, quite a while.
And this sort of helped you at all, do you think?
Well, I just like it. You see, I like all sports. I like any sport.
Let's go back now, Tommy, to some of the classic things you've done. Remind us about that super film we were talking about a few minutes ago called The Plank, which was marvellous. Eric Sykes. What do you remember about that?
I was terrified because I'd never done anything like that before in my life, film, you know. And Eric, he directed it and wrote it and everything, you know. And after about 3 or 4 days, I got into it. And then I realised that, you see, what I didn't realise about film, see, when they say action, you know, you can still take your time. But I didn't know that. When they say action, I go, right, you know, and you get, okay, because you think you've got to start straight away, but you don't have to. You know what I mean?
Of course, it was all mime too, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Do you prefer working that type of thing?
I like mime. I like mime. I tell you, I'm a great fan of Jacques Tati. Do you like him?
Mm.
I think he's marvellous. I saw him in Monsieur Hewlett's Holiday. I've seen most of his films. I think he's very funny.
Recently, you've been working again with Eric Sykes. You did rather a super television spectacular, didn't you? And you're telling me just now you've also done something else.
I just finished a film with Eric and a lot of people in it. Jimmy Edwards, Richard Bryars, a lot of well-known people, you know, that are in it. And I think, I'm not sure of the title, but I think it's going to be called Sorry, Darling.
Looking ahead, Tommy, to the future, what would you like to do that you haven't done? Is there anything you'd like to do or...
Yeah, I like to do some mime films, just mime films.
When you're at home, who makes you laugh? What sort of comics make you laugh?
Bob Hope, Morgan Wise, Frankie Howard, Eric Sykes, Jimmy Evers, George Burns, the old wonderful comic.
You obviously like the comedy of yesteryear in a way, some of the stars that have come up through vaudeville and variety.
Yes.
Is this something special, do you think, coming up through those days?
I don't know, really. I suppose there must be something because, you know, like vaudeville was a good training ground. That's what it was. It was a good training, you know. And it was lovely to see. I mean, we were talking just now about Rob Wilton. And another favourite, oh dear, was Max Miller. He was sensational.
You like Max Miller,
oh, yeah. He gave me one of his white hats.
Did he?
White Trilby hats, you know. He was marvellous.
When you're right away from show business, how do you relax? Do you like listening to music or anything like that?
Yes, I like all types of music. And funny enough, I just like doing magic. I could sit for hours just doing magic. It's like some people play golf, but I could sit for hours just doing little magic tricks. Silly, isn't it, really? A fully grown man doing little tricks.
Do people expect you to be funny all the time? I suppose they do they?
I don't know.
I can remember going back to 1963 at the London Palladium. You did a show with Frankie Vaughan and Cilla Black and Peter Goodright. Now, right at the start of that show, there was a screen and there was a silhouette and there was a man with a top hat and a cane. And everybody screamed because they thought it was Frankie
Vaughan.
That's
right.
It wasn't, was it? Who was it?
It was me.
Put that light out!
I'm trying to relax and listen to John Hannum.
In 1997, I drove down to the house of Russ Conway in Eastbourne.
John Hannum Meets.
Russ Conway, welcome back to John Hannum Meets.
Thank you very much, John Hannum.
I want to ask you a question I've never ever asked you in our long association.
Go, go, go.
It was a chance meeting in a London street that led to you sort of finding fame in the end, wasn't it?
Yes. I'd been playing piano in a pub in Wandsworth Road called the Nottingham Castle. Still there. And a funny piano, the piano keys, the black keys were green. And it was a strange thing to play, particularly as I was drinking pint after pint after pint, you know. And I sort of wandered and I spent all my money in the pub except a threepenny bit, an old threepenny bit. And I bought a pie, a hot pie at a stall in Vauxhall. And I walked over the bridge and I walked to Hyde Park and I had nowhere to sleep. I'd left all my Merchant Navy gear and everything in the lost property office or somewhere in a tube station. And I climbed the railings of Green Park and slept in the grass all night. And when I woke up the next morning, broke, damp, covered in birds, things, and dew, and I thought I will never, ever again be this low. And I got up, and the park was open by then, so I was able to walk through the gate legally. I must have looked in a state, you know. And I'm walking along Piccadilly going to get my suitcase, and I bump into a guy I'd met who I knew owned a club in the West End, a late-night drinking club. And he said, "Ah, Trevor," he said, "just the man I want. Our pianist has gone sick." This was a Saturday morning. "And our pianist has gone sick." He said, "Would you come and play for us tonight and tomorrow for the weekend, finish the weekend?" I said, "Yeah, sure. Lend me a fiver," I said, "so I can go and buy a clean shirt." And he did. He gave it to me eventually. And so I went and bought a clean shirt and I went down to the tube station, cleaned myself up, put on the new shirt and turned up at this club in London in the evening at about 7 o'clock, ready to shock or please the customers. I think I did both. And into the club that night, for the first and only time, he'd never been back since, he tells me, came two people. First was Irving Davis, the dancer, choreographer, who had with him Norman Newell, who was later to become my recording manager, my mentor, in fact, if you like. And first of all, Irving Davis came over to me and said, "Would you like to be my rehearsal pianist?" And I said, What do you mean, rehearsal pianist?" I said, "I can't read music." He said, "But you can learn it by ear, can't you?" I said, "Yeah, easily," which I could do and still can. And so I went to work for Irving on the Monday morning at Dynley's rehearsal rooms in, we were just off Baker Street then. And during that period working with him, I wrote a tune, first tune I'd ever written. He was called out from rehearsal by a telephone call, and the other end of it was Ernest Maxim, BBC producer. And Ernest told him, he said, "We're doing a sort of Frankie Howard outside broadcast from Earl's Court. Would you and your partner care to do a spot in Irving?" Because he was a very famous man at the time. It was Irving Davis, Beryl Kay and Paddy Stone, and they worked with and alongside Joyce Grenfell in all her shows. And so Irving came back, he agreed to do the show. Irving came back into the rehearsal room and said, "Write me a tune to dance to." I said, "I've never written music in my life." He said, "Now's the time to stop." So I did. I said, where it came from, I don't know, but it was obviously part of the process. It was all coming out. It was the time, the right time for me. And I wrote this tune, and because it was the first tune I'd ever written, I called it Primera. I recorded it with Brian Fay with a huge orchestra later. On that occasion, we had to get it all orchestrated and arranged, and I'd never met an arranger, let alone the great almighty Eric Robinson, you know, who, for people who don't know him, was the number one conductor in BBC orchestras in those days. We're talking about the mid and late 50s. So Irving says, "You've got to meet Arthur Wilkinson, the arranger." And I said, I can't even write the music down. He said, "Just play it to the man." So I played it to the man who wrote it all down. How he did it, I still don't know to this day. But he did it exactly as I played it. And at the end of the week, they were moving into the rehearsal rooms in Cecil Marsh House in London. And there was this Arthur Wilkinson, and he had the arrangement. And he said, "I'll play it, what I've done." And he played it exactly the way I could hear it in my head and the way I played it, you see. And the next thing I know is we go to the rehearsal in the for the orchestral rehearsal at Earl's Court, where Frankie Howard is doing this outside broadcasting. And there's the great Eric Robinson, you know, and I am shaking in my boots. And he turns around and said, "Right, who wrote this? Who's the composer? Tell me something about it, somebody." And Irving shoved me in the back, you see. And up I go in, and he said, "Sit here." And I sat on an upturned beer keg or something, which sort of seemed very appropriate under all the circumstances. And he said, right, what's the tempo? And I said, what is tempo? He said, how fast did it go? Hum it to me. So I went, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Thank you very much, he said. And I said, you stay there and tell me whether I go wrong. You know, which was such a calming gesture. You know, made me very calm. And bless him, and the orchestra played it. And I was on the moon hearing a piece of music played with this huge 80-piece orchestra. Can you imagine it? And it sounded brilliant. The one thing I'll never forgive myself for, or somebody I won't forgive, is I never got a recording of that actual broadcast, which is a great shame. But later on, I recorded it when Irving was going to America with Joyce Grenfell and Paddy Stone and Beryl Kay. And before he went, he rang Norman Newell and reminded him of the pianist he'd met in the club that night. And he said, I don't want to leave him doing nothing outside of the business, just playing in a club. Find him something to do, Norman. So Norman takes me to Teddy Holmes of Chappells and gets me a job in Chappells music publisher. And it's all step by step is moving on, isn't it?
Looking back, when you sort of, you played piano for lots of famous singers.
Well, that came out later, of working for Chappells, you think.
Dennis Lotus, Joan Regan, Dot Squires. And looking back, Russ, how important was that
Shaney
for
Wallace,
you?
Shaney Wallace, Adelaide Hall.
Terrific. How important Lita was Rosa. That for you?
Oh, very, very. I learned stagecraft, a lot of stagecraft from all the artists I worked for, particularly the ladies, Lita Rosa and Joan Regan and Dorothy Squires, particularly so from Dorothy Squires, bless her.
Sadly, since we last bless met, her. She's died.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I went to her funeral. Funny thing that they had two funerals because she died in Wales, and one undertaker brought her after a service down there, brought her as far as the Severn Bridge, and then, poor dear, she was transferred to another undertaker's hearse to bring her up to London. And I thought to myself, the Severn Bridge, if it's a windy night, it might well be a burial at sea, you know. And only Dorothy could achieve that under the circumstances. Yeah.
She would have liked that, wouldn't she?
She would have loved it. She was a real character, Dorothy. I loved her.
By Jove! Ha ha ha! How tatty-falarious, folks! How discombobulating to listen to that wonderful programme full of rumbunky nunciousness, John Hannam Meets. Good gracious me.
I know that voice. Thanks, Ken, for that free voicer. I also know this voice, and I went to Denham Village to meet Sir John Mills.
John Hannam Meets.
Currently, I'm at Denham, at the home of the wonderful Sir John Mills, looking back on the early part of his career and remembering the Isle of Wight and fond memories of that, haven't you, really? Fond memories of the Isle of Wight.
Very fond.
Mm.
Very fond.
1932, your very first film. Midshipmate, I think, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Now, that was another bit of luck. I seem to be lucky, don't I? I was playing in Noel's review, Words and Music, at the Adelphi Theatre, and they wanted a young actor who could sing and dance to play opposite a very, very big star that I am, Jesse Matthews. And so I didn't have to audition for films. I just got right in and went down and filmed at Gaumont British, I think, for about 3 weeks. Now, at that time, West End actors rather looked down on movies, and they would say, you know, I'm just doing this for the money. And but I didn't feel like that. I liked the studios. I liked the feel of it. I thought it was difficult and a challenge, and so I thought I'd have a crack at it, and I did. And I read a book called Brown and Resolution, which I thought was me, and I got into that. It was called Forever England, and I had a big hit in it.
Goodbye, Mr. Chips. That was a good film too, wasn't it? Very good for your career.
That was nice. It was with a big star called Robert Donat. That was quite an early one too, yes.
So, John, you've always sort of, a lot of people have said you play an upper-class Englishman and you play an officer so well. Were you ever worried of getting typecast in those?
No, because luckily I never was typecast.
No, I don't think you were.
I was able to mix it all up, and I played wild parts, I mean, Cockney parts, Lancashire parts, old men, young men, and weird parts. So I was determined not to get typed, and I think I managed to avoid it.
I'm sure you did.
I played a lot of those chaps because when I came out of the army, They were making a lot of very, very good war films, and I was only too happy to do them because I thought, well, I'm not in it now, at least I can put the boys up there in the way they would like to be seen, because I knew them. I knew how they behaved and everything, and I was very lucky to get in some very good movies.
When you were discharged from the war in 1942, I think then you decided on a movie career, and then a string of hit movies, really, The Way to the Stars, In Which We Serve, Great Expectations,
yes.
Hobson's Choice, Scott of the Antarctic.
Well, it's then another bit of luck was, at the time I worked with David Lean, in Which We Serve. He co-directed with Noel, and then he became one of the great directors of the world. And I made five with David, so it was enormously lucky. So they were, the pictures I was making at that time were very good.
Hobson's Choice.
You like that one?
Yeah, people love that, don't they? Do you still
it? I adored it, and I love William Ossop, and he became one of my very favourite characters. I've still got Willie's cap, which is tiny and very funny. And, of course, I worked with Charlie Lawton for the first time, and that was marvellous. And it was a very, very happy film.
Scott of the Antarctic.
That was a lovely one to me. I had a great vacation on that. And
where was that one actually filmed,
well,
Sir John?
We filmed in Norway in Finnsel, the glacier, and also in the Jungfrau in Switzerland. It was a very, very tough location. I remember one day, the day we shot the ponies in Norway, there was a blizzard, and we had two Arctic explorers working with us. And he came up to me and said, you know, Johnny, you're working in conditions that no self-respecting explorer will be seen outside in. And we had the cameraman got frostbite. And I think that's why Scott succeeded, because it was real. It was tough, tough to make.
Great Expectations, too. That was another John Mills gem, wasn't it?
Well, that was David Lean again, you see, and it was a really super film. And David rang me. By this time, he was a very hot ticket after In Which We Serve. And he said, I've got another film I'd like you to do. And I said, what is it? He said, well, it's a good story, but it's a very difficult part. It's a sort of coat hanger. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, it's a sort of coat hanger to hang wonderful characters on, but I'd love you to have a crack at it. And I said, what is it? He said, Pip in Great Expectations. And of course, I loved the book. And we started it, and it was one of those movies that halfway through we felt we had a success. It was an extraordinary feeling. It was Alec Guinness's first film, and he was very nervous, and he was wonderful. And Finlay Curry, Maltita Hunt, and it was just one of those things that happened. And it is now considered one of David's classic films.
What was it like making movies in those days, just after the war? It must have been a lot different to sort of later on when it was Ryan's Daughter and those other big movies.
Well, it was exciting, and we had to be careful. We had very small budgets, and expectations cost very little, and It was a nice time to work.
You obviously were very happy that your two daughters went into the business, really, weren't you?
No, I was very unhappy.
Oh, were you?
Well, I wasn't that happy, but I mean, you know, we tried to persuade them not to join.
Oh, did you?
Well, I mean, it's a dreadful profession. I mean, it's precarious. You never know when you're going to work, when you're not going to work. And it's overcrowded. And I always tell everybody not to join, but they don't listen. And they both joined, and luckily, God gave them some talent, and they both succeeded in quite a big way. So, you know, we're delighted.
In The October Man, you played a murder suspect, and I think I'm right in saying Juliet was in that one, a very small part.
Yeah, she was six, I think, six or seven. She was in another one I made, but very young, a Lawrence story. History of Mr. Polly, I produced that for Rank, so I popped her into that one too.
Always remember The History of Mr. Polly, because when I was at school studying my A-levels, whatever, that was one of the books that we had to read.
Yeah,
I
lovely
think.
Story, wasn't it?
Lovely story.
Yes. I got into trouble for that.
Did you?
Because at that time I was playing a lot of the blue-eyed heroes, and as you know, Polly started to be a very henpecked little man, and bossed around by his wife and looking very unattractive, and they didn't go for that at all.
I want to talk about Ryan's Daughter, because that's a film that most people remember you for among many films, but
yes.
Because you didn't speak in that one,
that's
did you?
That's right.
And you won an Oscar, which wasn't bad.
That's right. I remember now getting the Oscar. And, actually, during the filming, I used to watch the rushes with David every day. And one day we were watching the scene in the village with the lobster. Do you remember that scene?
Yes.
And he suddenly looked at me and said, Johnny, have you ever had an Oscar? I said, no. No more was said. And I got it 8 months later. He was very, very, very extraordinary, David. He could pick things out, and he knew when I got the Oscar. That was quite funny, because I was allowed to take Mary and Juliet. And when I got up there, I said, well, I'm very delighted, but of course I've been wasting my time. I get an Oscar for not speaking.
Oh,
and
I
learning
love it.
All those lines. Because when I was filming in Dingle, I had no lines. I did all my work, a lot of work on the part before I started shooting. But I was drinking Guinness in the pub at night, and they were sweating their lines at home, so it was terrific.
You played Michael in that, didn't you?
Yes, Marvel's part.
It's great. He's got a swell personality. He meets and greets the stars with such amenity. Good enough to make you coming out of the street. John Hannamade. That's right.
Thank you so much for listening to another John Hannamade's Archive. Today, it's been part one of my mini-series called Gone But Not Forgotten. Coming soon, part two, featuring Adam Faith, Norman Vaughan, and Hugh Lloyd. Looking forward to that. Bye-bye for now.
Sweet man. Who was he again, dear?
John.
John.
Yes.
Yes, John.
Just John.
Hannam. Was it?
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. What does he do?
He talks to people like you and me, dear.
Oh, I see. Mm. Yes.